Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where have all the WASPs gone? The shorthand term for white Anglo-Saxon Protestant wasn't in common usage until sociologist Digby Baltzell wrote about American aristocracy and caste in 1964. Ironically, by that time, the power and prestige of WASP culture, not to mention the fortunes of many of its once illustrious families, had fallen into a marked decline. That was just a couple of years after writer Tad Friend was born into WASPhood. While his parents' generation was the last to grow up with cooks and maids and nannies, Friend's upbringing was still very much shaped by WASP codes of behavior, which covered everything from money, avoid spending it, to education, Ivy League only please, to bodily functions, pretend they don't exist. Friend's new memoir tells the story of his WASP upbringing, his emergence from it, and his attempts to find his own way in a world that no longer matched the expectations of his ancestors. Tad Friend is a staff writer at The New Yorker. His new book is called Cheerful Money: Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor. Tad, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
So we all know what the acronym stands for, but as you point out in the book, it's broad enough to include people like Elvis and Bill Clinton, neither of whom really personify WASP culture. So what else does it mean to really be a WASP in America?
I think the shorthand that I use, because as you point out, the sort of strict definition is too broad for the kind of people I'm writing about. The sort of thumbnail sketch would be people with a fancy name who went to a fancy school. A fancy name being like my dad's name, Theodore Wood Friend III.
And what do you think is the reason that this group of people became so tied into a particular set of social norms?
That's a great question, and it's something that it's hard to address simply. I would say that probably the roots of it, if you go back to those guys who wore the black coats and the funny hats, the Puritans, they sort of set in place a lot of the norms of rigor and of trying to discourage any kind of emotional rebellion whatsoever. I mean, any child who rebelled against his parents in ancient Massachusetts could be put to death. And I don't think that rule is still in the books, but the sort of workaday analogy to that is still in place, where when I was growing up, my parents, who loved me and I loved them, but they just didn't really want to hear about anything that was going on inside me.
Yeah, you write about the fact that both your mom and your dad were much better at soothing physical wounds than any kind of emotional pain.
That's right. My mom's, and what I was trying to do with the book was not just present, you know, my parents as sort of mysterious emotional ogres, which they weren't, but to try to talk a little bit about how they themselves, when they were growing up, had the same circumstances in their childhood. But, you know, my mom's version of sex education was bringing into my room a book with one of those funny line drawings of human bodies and sort of putting it on my bed and saying, this might be helpful, and leaving. So we weren't really supposed to talk about anything that was actually going on. And when I did try to bring things up, would get a very hyper-rational response. Sort of the emotional side was just something that wasn't addressed at all.
What do you think makes WASPs so deeply suspicious of outsiders, particularly, and you write about this at multiple occasions, Catholics and Jews were not welcome in traditional WASP culture?
They weren't. I argue that I think a strong culture welcomes competition because it believes it can win. I think WASPs, by virtue of having been here a long time and not having much competition, began to fear that they weren't as strong as they had always told themselves they were. So they passed a number of very strong anti-immigration acts in the 20th century, and famously at the Ivy League institutions put in place restrictions upon particularly Jews, which is not the act of a strong group at all. It's people who, you know, begin to fear that they are not able to live up to their own rhetoric, which is their rhetoric is to be God's chosen people who are here not only to guide America, but the whole world into the light.
I mentioned this in the introduction, but maybe you can expand a little bit on the difference between the circumstances in which your parents were raised and you. Because by the time you were a kid, your mom and dad at times were sort of struggling a little bit with finances.
Yeah, I think you're right. In the intro, you said that my parents were the ones who grew up with, you know, cooks and nannies and so forth. And they did. And they were the last generation in my family, and I also think in a lot of people's family, that had that. They grew up before, they were children before World War II, and World War II sort of marked the end of that whole way of life where, you know, what used to be the maid's wing in those old country houses was now suddenly being occupied by the kids. When we grew up in Buffalo, we grew up in a, you know, a small house. My dad was an academic who was earning, you know, $6,000 to $10,000 a year, and we didn't have any help. So my mom, to her great credit, learned how to do all the things that it was never expected that she would have to learn how to do. She learned how to cook. She learned how to take care of us. But it was a struggle, and I think she'd been raised to believe that she would have one way of life with a lot of help. As a result, we children often felt that we were being dragooned into service as her maids and nannies.
Yeah,
there was a certain way that she would ask, you know, say, who would like to unload the dishwasher that sent everyone scurrying off to the far wings of the house.
Yeah, and she would say it like, what a treat this will be for you.
Oh, exactly, yeah. Wouldn't you like to help? And she would do that even at our wedding. She was, you know, sort of, I remember she was greeting people on the line, asking them if they'd like to help out doing certain things, you know, which was our wedding, and people were probably there just to be guests, but she was sort of thinking maybe they could pitch in a little bit.
And maybe as a response to having to learn to do all these things that she didn't think she would have to do, your mom was also, she very sort of carefully controlled what she could. You write about the fact much later in her life when she sort of branded herself as a grandmother.
Right. Yeah, usually I think grandmother's names are sort of bottom up. They come from the grandchildren, you know, and it's usually a mispronunciation that becomes something endearing and, you know, becomes umpa or something. But she was determined not to let it be out of her control, and so sent around an email suggesting a series of possible names that she could be called, because she didn't want to be anything having to do with, she didn't want to have anything to do with being a grandmother, really, although she would have been a very good one had she lived. So she thought Grandma E sounded too much like Grammy, and there were a bunch of other things. She wanted to be Puff, but then my brother suggested that that sounded a little bit like marijuana use. So she finally came up with Fafia, which is actually impossible for a child to say because it's too many syllables. So it got shortened by my brother's kids to Fafi. And that's still what everyone calls her, even though she's not around anymore. Hmm. She put it on her license plate, Fafia, just to make sure that we got it.
She was a promising poet and a painter when she was young, and it seems like she sacrificed a lot of that to get married.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think when we talked later in life, I mean, she did, once we had grown up, she went back to painting. And in fact, she hadn't really painted when she was younger. She was a poet. But she took up painting and became a very accomplished painter. And she was always, you know, once she'd learned how to cook, she became a really excellent cook, which is unusual for wasps, because usually wasp food is the equivalent of the food you get from the lunch ladies at your high school. She did feel, I think, thwarted by giving up work. And she'd, you know, gone on and gotten a master's at Yale and was very bright and, you know, would have made a terrific executive at a company or, you know, a great teacher. And would have been a very good poet. I mean, I found a poem in her computer after she died that she hadn't told anyone she was writing. It was a really lovely poem, and I gave it to the poetry editor at The New Yorker, where I work, and they ended up publishing it. And it wasn't, I think, just a special favor for Tad. It was an actually genuinely good, accomplished poem.
Do you sense that she resented missing that part of her life?
Well, it was something she and I talked about years later once I'd had a little therapy and felt able with some battalions at my side, battalions of self-knowledge, to talk about some of these things with her. You know, she did say that she felt like she had children before she was ready to. And I think it was, we didn't really address whether she resented me for coming along and sort of basically requiring so much work that she couldn't do professional work of her own. But I think it was sort of in the air that in her generation, it was still, which was just slightly before the feminine mystique, it was still the idea, particularly among the kind of people she grew up with, that women could have avocations but not vocations.
Yeah, you write about the fact that even when you were a very small child, like I guess toddler age, you had the sense that you had somehow failed to delight your mother.
Yeah, she. I had that sense, and she was a wonderful party guest all her life, and people loved to sit next to her. She told amusing anecdotes. She was a great listener. She was very good at badinage and banter and back and forth. And I think, as she told me directly. She became more interested in all of us children once we sort of got a little further along and could make jokes and kind of volley back to her. And there was this idea that, you know, the mother-child relationship should be sort of a no-collar play in some senses, which is nice when you're an adult, but that probably misses out some important constituents when you're a child.
This brings up the fact that, there were, at least for your parents' generation, clearly defined roles, not only within the family for men as opposed to women, but socially.
What are you getting exactly?
Well, women were expected to be the ones who were witty at parties, and men were not right. really expected to stand up and charm everyone.
No, men are expected to sort of stand in the corner with a drink in their hand, and when asked anything, just say they're doing tip-top or they're fine, and maybe talk about the markets a little bit. Women are, a lot of the WASP women I admire, the older women, are amazing, like hostesses. They put you at ease. They don't let you in the kitchen. They know the right question to ask. They may have even, in my mom's case, she would study up on party guests and keep, my mom was more of a perfectionist than most, but she would keep extended lists and books of exactly who sat next to who at what dinner party and what food was served to make sure that no one ever sat next to the same person twice or got served the same meal twice, which takes it way beyond any kind of level I would ever get into in having a dinner party, which seems like it should be sort of spontaneous and fun. And her dinner parties were fun, but they were not spontaneous.
It's sort of amusing. You copy in here, you reproduce a list that your mother created of having met your father's family for the first time, and she had notes about everybody, what somebody wore, and ways that she might remember them for the next time.
Yeah, I think it was a funny list because she would have a little shorthand about, drinks, or, proposed to so-and-so and it was accepted because his horse approved, that kind of thing. But she expected to be tested on things. And I think that's at least in my family, which is a very academic family on both sides of the family, the protocols of achievement were about being tested. My grandfather, had the highest grades in the history of Yale. And I think that was a residue that sort of lingered in the family, the idea that, you really ought to. And his father and his brother had also been valedictorians at Yale. So if you weren't a valedictorian, you were pretty much, out of luck.
And yet throughout the book, we have this sense of within that culture, the idea that family is destiny.
Yeah, I think the tricky thing for me as a child growing up, and it was something I was trying to sort out for my own satisfaction, and I hope the readers, was that we were never told growing up exactly that we were WASPs. That word was really never mentioned, and it only sort of, just because it was assumed, it was sort of in the bathwater. And we were never really told what the family heritage was supposed to be. We were always, the sort of explicit rhetoric was, you can be whatever you want to be. But if you wanted to be a B-plus student, that wasn't acceptable. Or if you wanted to, say, run a chain of gas stations, that wouldn't be acceptable. The rhetoric was that, America's a wonderful country of boundless opportunity. You've been very privileged. You were able to take advantage of it. But you probably would be supported if you took advantage of it in certain ways and not others.
And that seems to have been an easier sell to your brother, for example, than it was to you.
Yeah, my brother, he works at Goldman Sachs and has, you could argue that it's complicated because the family for years was not about making money and, in fact, about losing money or trying to hold on to money, which is a very WASP thing, trying to maintain and put a stopper against fortunes that are receding. But my brother has gone to work for Goldman Sachs and actually made money, which is both traditionally WASPy and in recent years anti-WASPy.
Tad Friend is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called Cheerful Money, Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New Yorker staff writer Tad Friend. His new book is called Cheerful Money: Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor. You can join us with a question or stories of your own last days of WASP Splendor by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Ted, let's talk for a minute about your title. Your parents actually paid you and your brother and sister to act in a cheerful manner.
They did. And then actually, financial incentives are a pretty standard WASP behavioral management tool. For better or worse, a lot of people have spunk boxes for bad behavior or a child of the week who gets a cash reward. My parents decided that we, the three of us, particularly me, were being too glum. So they put aside three glass jars, and if you were supposedly spontaneously, helpful or cheerful, you got a quarter or two dropped in your jar. And whoever had the most money at the end of the year would have that sum doubled. My brother, the one who works at Goldman Sachs, won every year, and I was last every year. He now argues cleverly that since you were supposed to use the money that you won to pay for Christmas gifts for your siblings, that actually, by coming in last, I won because I got the best gifts.
You write about the fact that WASPs tend to be cheerful but not optimistic.
Yeah, I think the narrative of the WASP, and particularly in the last sort of three generations, has been one of decline and of trying to maintain a position that is eroding. So when you look ahead, you see only further decline. Nonetheless, the sort of default mode of WASPdom is relentlessly cheerful. You know, as with cheerful money, the incentive, you are supposed to never complain, never explain, and be peppy. Peppy is kind of the sort of perfect WASP mode. And as a result, you know, since most people are not feeling peppy most of the time, it's a culture of sort of built-in distance and a kind of lying.
Are WASPs more or less happy than the average person, do you think?
Do we ever know how happy or unhappy other people really are? I mean, I think everyone always pretends to be happier than they are. People rarely pretend to be unhappier than they are. I would say WASPs do a better job of hiding their happiness than other people. I don't know. I wouldn't pretend to speak to whole groups of people about their quantum of happiness, but I think WASPs dissemble better.
Yeah, you write about the fact that when your mother was happy, it was almost rude for her to behave in a bullying fashion. She would just sort of tamp it down like everything else.
Yeah, I think sort of high spirits and larking would be condoned among children if they were outside or if they could be sent outside. But too much just sheer unfettered exuberance, there was usually someone who just felt that was unseemly.
There are a number of rogues in your family. We should say, despite all these rules and these strictures, there are plenty of people on your family tree that have sort of taken what they liked and thrown the rest out the window.
That's true. My cousin Nora was sort of a leading example. She had an abortion at around age 18. She didn't have an abortion. She gave up her child for adoption. Her parents encouraged her to have an abortion. Because she wasn't married, and then she sort of basically refused to go to college and fled the family and went out west and smoked marijuana on the porch of the family house and was cranky and difficult and strangely lovable and gradually sort of worked her way back into the family. I think, as I kind of say in the book, that, you know, eccentrics are tolerated as long as you show up for Christmas. There's an expectation among WASP almost that there's an understanding that these rules are too difficult for most of humanity to follow, and that people are necessarily going to, you know, cut loose in one way or another. And there are cousins who went off to India or cousins who ended up in insane asylums. But they're still part of the family as long as they sort of, you know, make an effort to stay in touch, even if it's only to threaten you over the phone.
But I'm guessing that there's only room for one or two eccentrics around any Christmas dinner table.
Yeah, I think the idea is you should have one. Any more than that is probably, you know, untenable. But having one is fine and expected, and everyone sort of is on their best behavior and tries to make it work. But once you have more than one in a family, then the family begins to sort of founder.
You have two children yourself now. How has this made you think back upon your relationship with your dad?
Well, I think anyone who, I mean, it's not peculiar to WASP, but anyone who has children always ends up thinking that it's much harder to raise children than you ever thought when you were a child and you were blaming your parents for various things that turn out not to be their fault.
They get much smarter after you have your
own
children,
what Mark
they?
Twain famously said is, you know, as he grew up, he realized his dad was much smarter than he thought. And they get smarter, and also you realize that you, you know, despite your most determined efforts not to repeat the things you didn't like when you were a child, are doing the same damn thing over again, and wanting, in my case, you know, I find myself occasionally wanting 2 or 3 year old children to behave in ways that 2 or 3 year old children don't, which is in, you know, WASPy polite ways, and having the same kind of irrational reaction that troubled me about in my parents. At the same time, I think the one main thing that I alluded to earlier that I want to not pass on is I'd really want my children to feel like they can talk to me about anything that comes up, particularly emotional things, and not just get advice about, you know, colleges or career choices, but to be able to talk about the things that are troubling them. And I think if my wife and I can achieve that, then we'll have raised the bar a little bit.
Your mom did go to therapy for a little while early in her life, which she found out much later. But both of your parents expressed sort of, they were confounded by the relief that you found in spending years in therapy.
Yeah, I think they were, each of them had been in some kind of therapy. In fact, my brother is the only one in the family who's never done any therapy. And we were an unusual family, particularly along my mother's side of the family, in that her father, who'd had a nervous breakdown, had been in psychoanalysis, and she'd been in psychoanalysis briefly, which she later told me had enabled her to get married. But when I spending sort of ended up 13 years in a combination of therapy and then later psychoanalysis, my mom, just as that went on, just began to be troubled, thinking, like, you know, that it was too much of a good thing, and that, you know, even though I seemed to be happier and more expressive, that, you know, it would be, there was something unbounded about continuing with it, and it might be better just to call a halt, both for my finances and for, so lest I get sort of too creative and expressive and happy.
Interestingly, in her own way, she did acknowledge that perhaps some of your issues with relationships might have had to do with the way that she raised you.
Yeah. I mean, we had a conversation, I guess about 10 years ago now, in which she said, you know, she was asking about the state of my relationships, which at that point was non-existent. I wasn't seeing anyone seriously and had no prospects. But I sort of batted her away because I just didn't want to have to talk about it with her, because I always felt she was criticizing that lack of relationship. And she was actually at that point trying, she said, I'm just acknowledging that I may have had some impact on your difficulties and want to help. So we had a, you know, it was a nice, loving instinct of hers. And we had a candid, difficult conversation that ended up with both of us in tears, which wasn't exactly the intended outcome for either of us. But it was hard to talk about those things because I was still at that point angry at her about the very thing she was alluding to, which was the fact that by keeping me at a distance, you know, I'd sort of, not to sound overly psychotherapeutic about it, but that I'd, that was my expectation for relationships, was that you would sort of stand at arm's length.
Well, it must be tough, too, when you spend a lot of your life yearning for that sort of open and honest relationship. When it actually presents itself, you're not really prepared to deal with it.
Yeah, yeah. They'll lure you in and just to sort of whisk away the chair. That's a little bit of a feeling. It's puzzling. You know, and then the trick is not to just find that distance and that waspiness so comfortable that you can't respond to anything else. You get used to sort of the chilly bathwater.
Tad Friend is my guest. His new book is called Cheerful Money: Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Sarah in Dallas. Hi, Sarah.
First of all, I'm so excited Tad's on the show. I'm a big fan of his New Yorker writing, and I've read the book, and it's a wonderful book, and I encourage everyone to buy it. But
you're the perfect guest so far.
At the end of the book, he has a conversation with his father where he reveals that he's near the end of his therapy or has just discontinued therapy, and I wanted to know how he knew that the talking cure was over and that it had worked, and you know, how he'd come to that decision, and if it's still true.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, it's still true. We had that conversation. My dad, as I was mentioning a minute ago, had also been concerned that I was spending sort of too much of my life being taken over by the Freudians. and he felt there are other ways of thinking about life, which there are. And I told him in a candid conversation we had that I was had now stopped. But then I wanted to make it clear to him that it wasn't because he told me not to. I was still being the angry son. It wasn't because you told me. It was because I wanted to do it myself. And the way I arrived at that was I had actually been intending to stop a few years earlier, and then my mom died, and it didn't seem like a good time to stop because I was, you know, it was very devastating, particularly because we had a few things that we had started to work on together, she and I, in talking, but everything wasn't resolved. And it's harder when you have ambivalent feelings when someone dies because you can't fix that relationship. So I spent a couple more years in it, and then at a certain point, it just came to seem to me like I wasn't perfectly healthy or perfectly happy, but I'd reached some sort of plateau where I felt like I could kind of carry the backpack myself.
You wrote a really interesting magazine piece about your mom, and it's interesting because your father read that and thought that it portrayed her and the whole family in a really negative light. And reading it, I don't get that sense. There's a lot of affection along with things that might seem more critical. But that was sort of an issue for you and your dad for a long time.
It was. And I think, you know, and he was not alone in the family in feeling that it was too critical of her, and it was critical of her. I thought it was lovingly critical, and I tried to be candid, and I also tried not to spare myself and make it seem like I was, you know, this perfect, wonderful human being who'd been treated horribly by this harpy, because that wasn't at all the case. But I think families inevitably, you know, no one ever asks people to write, you know, candid personal histories or memoirs. You know, the assumption in a family is that you're going to keep all this stuff within the family. And so my dad, when he'd read that piece that was in the New Yorker before it was published, I'd given it to him to ask if he had any problems with it or if there's anything he wanted to change. He was very positive about it, but when it appeared in print and all of a sudden his friends started calling him and talking to him about it, I think he had a different reaction just because it was suddenly outside the family. It was out in the world. And things that you might say, you know, perfectly cheerfully in the family seem take on a different valence when everyone's reading about them and forming their own conclusions.
Well, you sort of broke the ultimate WASP taboo.
You did, which is sort of, you know, don't frighten the horses, don't talk about anything at all about the family outside of it. I mean, there are WASP families where I know where the children of loving parents who had a long, happy marriage never even knew how their parents met. It was never talked about. No one would ever discuss it.
Did you ever find yourself wishing that you fit into that, where it felt perfectly natural to follow what your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had done before you?
Never. More the opposite. More, you know, having the sort of classic childhood fantasy of growing up in another family and, you know, where, you know, you come home and there'd be big hugs and let's go throw the ball. And there was some of that in my family, but I always felt like, I had been found in a little rush basket in the water or something and smuggled in this family and wanted to sort of get out.
When you think about passing on values of your parents, and you mentioned the sort of accidental things that we all do, are there things about the culture in which you grew up that you think are really valuable to give your kids?
At a sort of silly level, I think please and thank you and thank you notes. I seem to be stuck with those. I like thank you notes. No one sends them anymore, but I think we'll probably encourage our kids to at least write a thank you email or text. At a more serious level, the one thing that I think WASPs, I think never complaining is actually a reasonably good thing to follow, as long as there's a distinction made between complaining and expressing feelings. But, you know, whining, WASPs are anti-whining, and you know, to the extent that you can talk about your feelings without whining about them or being poor me, I'm in favor of that. The other thing that WASPs, I think, do very well is sort of pitch in and serve on committees and give anonymous gifts and, you know, run things at the local library. And there's sort of a tradition of anonymous service, which can be a bit of noblesse oblige at its worst, but at its best is something that, you know, sort of helps us all get through our days, and I think that's something we try to teach our kids, is that you have an obligation to give back, and that, I mean, again, I ended up probably dressing it in the same sort of slightly language of privilege that I got it from my parents, but that they are lucky. They do have more resources than most people in the world, and they should not just squat on them, but actually use them for other people's benefit.
Is there still a relatively small circle of prep school kids to whom you're connected across the country by just a couple of links?
There is still a relatively small group of prep school kids. There is still that sort of feeling of, you know, there's a friend of mine named Adam Platt, who's the restaurant reviewer for the New York Magazine, and he and I kind of met seemingly by chance in New York. But then it turns out that, like, you know, the family connections go back for generations. His great-grandfather designed the house of my godmother's, you know, grandmother, and my godmother's husband was his godfather. It's all this connections, and my dad used to date his mom briefly. There's all this stuff that we sort of just the unspoken texture of WASP relationships, where it is a tiny world, but we didn't even know that. We just thought we met independently, but we would have somehow met through one of those other connections at a certain point. And if Adam mentioned someone who I don't know, it turns out that they are, as you were saying, like, there's one link away where you can think, oh, well, their sister is so-and-so. So there's still that world. I don't spend most of my time in it. Most of my friends are not WASPs now. And I don't, truth be told, really like spending all my time with WASPs, but I can find that it's like, you know, it's a little bit like coming home at the end of the day and putting on your slippers. It's a comfortable world for me to slip back into, but I worry about its comforts.
How did you sort of isolate the WASP factor as being the overwhelming force in who you became and who you grew out of and into?
Well, I think, you know, the book tries to not just make it about WASP, but of course, you know, that's the thing people fasten on because it's not usually discussed, as we were talking about earlier. But it seemed to me, this, even though it was never discussed when we were growing up, that we were WASPs, you know, if I didn't write about it, I wouldn't be able to explain who I was because it was such a strong cultural impress. So many of the factors that were in my life and that I kind of took for granted were things that were affecting people of my age all across the country, or at least in the small prep school elite, because everyone had those factors. Everyone had that kind of emotional distance and those expectations and those rigors. So I wouldn't be able to talk about myself as a person without talking about the group.
Ted Friend is with us. His new book is called Cheerful Money, Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tad Friend. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his new book is called Cheerful Money, Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. You write here briefly about George W. Bush, who has exceptional WASP pedigree in terms of his blood, but as a politician chose to really represent himself in an entirely different way. Can you relate to that?
I can understand the impulse. He, you know, his first race for Congress, he got beaten up by his local opponent, who kept pointing out about his Andover and Yale pedigree, and he lost against his local opponent. And I think that taught him a lesson that that was not a winning story in many parts of America. And I understand that because people are suspicious of WASPs, and the word WASPy is pejorative. And indeed, WASP itself usually has pejorative connotations or being sort of tight-assed and unpleasant and stiff. So I understand the impulse to run away from it, I guess. And you could argue that this book is kind of my a kind of flight, but it also is saying, like, I am a WASP, and here's what they are. And I think, you know, if you try to pretend to be something you're not with George Bush, it always struck me anyway that the sort of Texas-isms, which were part of him, but the way that he tried to pretend he wasn't, you know, hadn't gone to Yale and been in Skull and Bones and hadn't gone to Harvard Business School, seemed to me part of the inauthenticity of his character.
What do you think, Ted, that the rest of us, and I will tell you that I am a middle-class Irish Catholic person, that's my background, what do we misunderstand about WASPhood?
I think, you know, probably to my benefit because people seem interested in it. But I think people there's a fascination that belief that there's some sort of secret blood rituals going on, and that, that life, you know, but that there we're sitting there plotting in some way to do something mysterious or malevolent. A and B, there's the idea which WASP certainly try to cultivate that everything comes easily. You know, we go to the right schools, we look good, we dress in casual old clothes, and everything seems attractive and effortless. And in fact, one of the great WASP maxims is, you know, is to be like the duck, you know, where you're calm on the surface but paddling like hell underneath. And WASPs, you know, have to work hard like everyone else, and often do. And as we were discussing earlier, are often just as miserable, if not more so, than other people because they have fewer resources available to them in family or in terms of therapy than other people do.
Interestingly now, two of the great WASP icons of American culture are Martha Stewart and Ralph Lauren, neither of whom would really fit the title.
Well, yeah, neither of them. Yeah, Martha Stewart was a Polish Catholic, and Ralph Lauren was an, you know, Jewish immigrant son. So, but they admired the style of WASPdom, and they, we had an argument in my family between my mother and my father. My mom liked Ralph Lauren's pillow shams and liked, you know, all, you know, she thought this is like the highest quality iteration of the kinds of things she grew up with. My dad felt that, you know, Ralph Lauren was an imposter and you shouldn't support him because he was, you know, stealing a heritage that wasn't his, simply put. So they would argue about it. My mom would just be like, well, I like the pillow shams and I like the dust ruffles and they look great. And that's the end of it. She tended to win most of the arguments.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Arlington and speak with Ed. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I thought I heard Mr. Friend earlier make a distinction between psychoanalysis and therapy. I wasn't aware that there was a difference. I was wondering if he could elaborate on his experiences with that difference.
Sure.
And I don't know, can I squeeze another quick one in?
A nice quick one, sure.
What does Mr. Friend attribute the demise of WASPdom to? Is it those damn Catholic Kennedys and their progressive income tax rates, or what?
We blame it all on the Kennedys. Actually, a lot of WASPs tend to blame it on Franklin Roosevelt, who was the traitor to his class, who came in as a WASP and then turned around and started, you know, helping all the poor and middle class people. The answer to what, you know, you blame it on, I mean, some people do go back as far as the, you know, as the federal income tax coming in. That was the beginning of the end in the early 20th century. But I in the book, try to say that the sort of final crack-up was 1965, which was 1 year after Digby Baltzel named the WASPs, or at least popularized the name. But it was the year that we kind of got really deeply embroiled in Vietnam, and it was the year of the first affirmative action programs, and the year that the first computers started talking to each other, and WASPs are famously left behind by technology. They're not very good with technology. And it was also the year, on a small level, that my dad sort of dropped his Roman numerals from his name and just decided that having the heritage was no longer something to be proud of. He would just be Theodore Friend from now on. On the question of psychotherapy versus psychoanalysis, there are probably better people to answer the question, but my understanding is that psychotherapy is basically once or twice a week and you're sitting up in a chair, and psychoanalysis is at least four times a week and you're lying down. So you can be doing it with the same person, but as I was, but the therapist will be talking less and you'll be talking more. And by lying there without being able to see him or her, in my case her, you kind of reach a different part of your mind and becomes less informational and becomes much more associational about dreams and memories and sort of the strange furry things at the bottom of your brain.
Can you talk for a minute about the fact that when your mother did take up painting later on, some of her work was really emotional and raw, and it was uncomfortable for you to look at?
In painting?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a painting she did, that's sort of her last major painting, after she'd had a very serious cancer scare, where she'd almost died, but mostly from the treatment for the cancer. And she wrote it, and it was, she both wrote about it and then did a painting. And the painting, yeah, I was sort of accustomed to her more of her still lifes, and sort of something like dappling through the window on a set of china was her kind of common thing, very exquisitely detailed and worked out. And this one was, you know, a series of mythical beasts and a self-portrait in which she looked pained and exhausted and stricken in some ways. And I found it like it was unexpected, and it was something that I actually should have responded to better than I did. But I was, it gets back to what we were talking about earlier about when someone, when you're used to sort of a distance and someone suddenly says, well, let's close that distance, which she was doing by painting that and sort of trying to close the distance with people around her and say, this is what I'm feeling now. I'm feeling this way. You know, I don't think I rose to the opportunity.
Well, it is interesting, you know, you talk about hoping that your kids will be able to talk about anything with you. And I know they're preschool age right now, but that also sort of requires you being able to talk to them about anything. Do you?
It absolutely does. Yeah.
Do you already worry about that?
Well, I wrote the book, so
they can just
in a way, you know.
You're not just going to toss it on their beds, though, right?
I am. I'm going to toss it and run away and then hope they never bring it up with me. I say that sort of jestingly, but it is true that I actually thought, you know, one way of kind of doing this is that when they get to the point where they can actually read, is that they can look through this and get a little bit of a sense of who I am. But you're absolutely right, and I think that's the when you have habits of sort of self-reliance, which can easily bleed into isolation, as I did growing up, it's hard. You have to fight it, and I fight it, you know, every day with my wife. Even just, you know, instead of just saying, "How was your day?" Fine. Saying, well, I was feeling upset about this, or here's what was going on, and having a longer conversational that's not just informational, but that actually conveys the texture of your feelings and what matters to you. And that's, you know, something with three-year-olds, as you were saying, that's not necessarily the first priority, but we do, you know, try to talk to them about sort of how they're feeling and get those things, get the ball rolling a little bit. But it's going to be harder once they are, like, you know, reach an age where they can ask you about stuff that is more uncomfortable. Like the question, you know, did you smoke pot, is a famous one for parents. Like, and if the answer is yes, then how do you frame that? And that's something luckily we have a few years, I hope, before when that comes up.
What you typically do for a living is write long-form magazine profiles. Is that the bulk of your professional life these days?
Yes.
Okay. It has to be fascinating to turn that lens on your own family. And I'm wondering if you can talk for a minute about how your closeness to the subject affects even things like fact-checking on the content.
In this particular book?
Yeah.
Well, I think I applied some of the reporting was kind of a similar method where I took a year off from the New Yorker, and I spent about 6 months kind of doing interviews, basically. I talked to my immediate family and cousins and aunts and family friends and then friends of mine and then ex-girlfriends and kind of tried to do a 360-degree view so I would be supporting my own sense of what had happened with other people's knowledge and perspectives, which is sort of, you know, what I do in a long-form piece, except I usually don't know as much about the topic before I start. But then the writing turned out to be quite different. I think writing a sort of narrative piece for The New Yorker is like a lot of sort of linear stuff where you need to be creative, but you have to get a certain amount of information into it, and a lot of it is just sort of craftsmanly trying to figure out, you know, how to do it in a way that makes sense and get from point A to point Z. And writing this kind of book turned out to be much more kind of turning off that part of your brain and trying to associate more, like a little bit more like the process of lying on a therapist's couch, I suppose. But at the same time, then at the end, you have to come back and reapply the New Yorker principles of like, well, does it make sense and does it go from A to Z and let's fix it up so it's a little bit clearer about, you know, what the narrative threads are.
It must be challenging, though, in that when you're writing a New Yorker piece, I doubt that, you know, every couple of days you're stumbling upon some revelation that explains something that you've always wondered about in terms of your own life and your behavior.
Yeah,
it's a
totally different process of engagement where and it also, it's different in the sense that, you know, in a way, you could argue I've been preparing to write the book for more than 40 years. Everything was deeply interesting to me in a way that was compelling and fresh, and writing a narrative about someone else you don't know can be totally fascinating, but then you finish it, and then sometimes you speak to them afterward, and sometimes you see them later, but usually you sort of move on. And in this case, you know, writing about my family, you know, I'm still here, and they're still here, and it's, you know, the gift that keeps on giving, some people in the family think, you know, have the same reaction of, like, why did you have to go write about that? So you stay engaged with the subject, you know, it carries on.
How did you feel giving the book to your dad for the first time?
I felt nervous, and, you know, I wanted him to like it, and I also wanted him to, you know, be able to see past the parts that were candid about some of the feelings that I felt in our relationship and the difficulties. And I hoped that I sort of said to him, I hope you'll see that their book has an arc, and it, you know, and as is true of our lives together, that it got to a better place at the end, as our relationship did. And part of the way it got there, I think, was that I spent a lot of time with him talking about the family and his childhood, and asking for his memories and his perspectives on things. And I think he hadn't had a lot of that necessarily in his life, because he'd been brought up in a way, even with not very much parental support or love or people saying I love you or hugging him or saying goodnight to him or any of those things. He was brought up sort of by the servants, and he and my mother did a much better job of raising us. But so he hadn't had a whole lot of people just being curious about what it was like to be him, and I think that process brought us closer together.
Is he able to see the humor in the book?
I hope so. I mean, I think, he has a good sense of humor, and he can see that parts of it are funny. I think it would be hard. I think, you know, if my brother or my dad or eventually my son wrote a book like this, I would have a complicated reaction to it. I mean, it's inevitable, because you can't approach it as objectively as a reader and just appreciate it as something that's outside you, because it's about something that treads so closely upon your own experience and that you're inevitably going to have experienced differently, you know. My perceptions are my own, and my dad doesn't share all of them. And he also wouldn't necessarily want me to write about certain things, which I did write about. So, you know, but to his great credit, he has been candid about the parts he doesn't like, and we've talked about them, and I think kind of moved through that. And I think he's able to see, you know, the humor and the tenderness in ways that maybe he couldn't about when I wrote the piece about my mom. And I think he's sort of able to see it a little differently now.
Of course, there's no rule that says you can only write one book about your life, but how do you know when a memoir is finished?
I think I knew once when my dad and I took a trip to Pittsburgh, and in sort of to revisit a city that I'd been banished from essentially since my step-grandmother scolded me for licking the ice cream spoon there when I was 8 years old. So I had never been back, and that was where he grew up, and we did a tour around the city, and that became the last chapter of the book. And I think I knew when I was leaving Pittsburgh then that was the end of the book. It just felt to me like that was the right resting point for the story that I knew so far. So then it was a matter of writing, you know, the rest of the book to get to that place.
Tad Friend is a staff writer at The New Yorker, to which he contributes the Letter from California feature. His new memoir is called Cheerful Money, Me, My Family, and the Last Days of Wasp Splendor. Tad, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is a production of KERA and is made possible by KERA listeners and supporters. The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.